You're listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation. I'm Tom Muller with the Cross Border Research Association. On this show, we explore the frontiers of customs creativity in conversations with customs and logistics experts, technology innovators, research scientists, and other leaders in the field. Industry insiders call this show the PenCast because it's part of PenCP, a network for boosting customs innovation funded by the European Union under the Horizon 2020 program. Today, I'm speaking with Edward Kieswetter, Commissioner of SARS, the South African Revenue Service, and as of June this year, Chairperson of the World Customs Organization. Hello, Edward, or Ed, if I may. Thanks for joining me on Pushing the Envelope.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. To start off, could you give our listeners a word on your background and what brought you to South African Customs in the first place?
Well, that's a long story, but let me start out by saying that I trained in electrical engineering. But because of socioeconomic conditions, I couldn't go to university. So I had to start work and study at night and did an apprenticeship and eventually qualified many years later in electrical engineering. Then ended up in accident by accident in education because I had one more subject to finish my four-year engineering qualification and took 6 months leave to do a semester. And when I spoke to the dean at the time, he said to me, "You're going to have so much time. Don't you want to take a class?" And I ended up teaching maths for first years and applied mechanics for first years. And I loved it. And so consequently, I kind of, by osmosis, became a teacher of engineering and science and mathematics to the point where I loved it so much. A few years later, I took off a year to do a postgraduate diploma in engineering and mathematics education and an honors degree in maths and science education. And eventually I did a master's degree in cognitive science. And during that time, I was fortunate to be awarded a very prestigious scholarship that gave me the opportunity to spend a semester at Harvard as an associate in education, working with one of the leading, two of the leading proponents in cognitive development, a guy by the name of Howard Gardner. The author
emotional
of
intelligence.
Multiple intelligences, David Perkins, who just was a prolific writer. So I spent time with them because I'd studied their stuff. And that was amazing. Came back to South Africa. Education is very politicized. I was then the head of the electrical engineering department at a technical university. And I decided to leave education because of its politicization and came back into engineering and started managing power plants for almost a decade. So I'm really where I cut my teeth as a young manager at Eskom. And by the time I left, I was managing a portfolio of stations, generation engineering, and generation commercial services. So very technical, but also leadership experience, for which I'm very happy to say I was voted South Africa's best boss when I was at Eskom, when I was the tender age of 39 years old. And that then gave me public profile. And I was subsequently headhunted by one of the big four banks. And I left and spent 4.5 years at the bank. And I was never really a happy banker.
Oh, first round banking, that was, is it?
Yeah, but I was never a happy banker. I could not reconcile the level of crass materialism by bankers. They worked from one bonus check to the other. And just lacked the kind of purpose that I had when I was a young power station manager, knowing the transformative impact of electricity on the lives of people. And it was in that time when I had a conversation with the then Minister of Finance, a former school colleague of mine, Trevor Manuel. He was Minister of Finance. And the conversation kind of led to me eventually joining the South African Revenue Service for my first stint. And, you know, in South Africa, revenue and tax and customs is under the same administration. Of course, along the way, I picked up a second master's degree in business administration. And when I joined SARS, I'm very scholarly. I said, well, if I'm going to be a taxman, I may as well understand it. So I registered for a master's degree, a third master's degree in South African and international tax law. And I found it so easy, but also for me, tax then restored my sense of higher purpose.
I see.
Because it's really, you know, whatever you may think of politics, you know, tax collection funds government programs. And when I become frustrated about my work, and I do, I promise you I do, because we are working against so many forces to be successful. But when I become frustrated, I then see in my mind's eye the face of the granny who without the monthly pension would be destitute, right? Or the face of a young boy and girl being able to go to a school that is safe, provided for by taxpayer money, or a nurse or a teacher that government can employ. And it's that then keeps me going. Because you and I would know we are of the privileged few who have a decent income and a decent living. But when governments fail, people with means, middle class and wealthy people, they can insure themselves against government failure, right? They can buy themselves out of a bad school and take private education, of writing on healthcare. People who have means can buy themselves out of poor public hospitals and buy private hospitals and healthcare. So whether it's security or teaching or healthcare, services which ought to be social goods, when governments fail, wealthy people can buy themselves out of it. So for me, taxpayer money and administering customs laws is more than just giving government resources. It is about addressing the most vulnerable in society who rely on government because they have no choice. And so that's really what inspired me at the first time when I came to SARS. And then in South Africa in 2009, the politics changed and I decided I wanted to leave government. And I was thankfully headhunted at the time by a financial services company who was in deep, deep trouble. They faced a billion rand civil claim and a total of 21 criminal charges.
Wow.
And I walked straight into it. And within a month of being there, I resolved the civil claim. And a year later, the 21 criminal charges.
Well, they chose well. They had
And you can Google it. It's called The Life Care Story, Alexander Forbes Life Care. But what was remarkable about that for me, it was about me returning to a discipline that I left because of the focus on money and the opportunity to demonstrate you can run an ethical financial services company. Because what I did and why we were able to resolve it, I walked in to the first meeting with the regulator and the curator and said, we're going to settle, but we're going to do so in a reasonable way and you're being unreasonable. And I looked at the regulator and said, and why are you allowing the curator to bully us? And I said, so I'm not leaving here until we come to a sensible agreement about where we settle. And we did that, you know, briefed the lawyers, and within a month we had an agreement. Then I went to the state prosecutor, the public prosecutor, and I said the same thing. I said, we're going to settle this. I am happy to plead guilty, give you the headline you want, because I think what had happened was unconscionable. But why do you want to destroy the whole company? Why do you want to destroy people? I says, now, a company is a piece of paper. You are already going after the individual directors. and individuals were involved in the scheme. They're new owners to the company, new management. The people who you are really angry with aren't here. So why are you fighting with the company?
Right.
And I'll spare you the technical details, but I had to understand the law, read exactly what the risks were, because they're usually legal risks when you plead guilty. Went to my board. The lawyers disagreed. The lawyers said to the board, we think we have a winnable case. I said to the board, I don't think it is about whether we can win this case. It's about whether we ought to win this case, and I don't think we should. And if you want to, you need a different CEO, because I can't do that in good conscience. And a year later, we had the front page headline, Alexander Forbes pleads guilty. But the way we had done it was actually gained us reputational credit and took a huge liability away from us, and the business grew. And 4 years later, we listed the company. And then I bought into a small university, a leadership school called Da Vinci Institute, because I always wanted to go back to teaching, and had my little small portfolio when basically in 2019, after 10 years of state capture and SARS had been decimated again, President Ramaphosa appointed me to go back and fix the revenue service. And that was what I've been doing the last 5 years. So that's how I ended up there again. All of the time driven by a sense of higher purpose.
Right. You can even make banking a higher purpose when you're trying to save the company and trying to do the right thing, which probably were messages that your counterparts in the negotiation process were not used to hearing.
Yeah.
and your lawyers were probably not too pleased with it.
No, my lawyers were going off their rockers. This was going to be a landmark case for them, because it was about the unconstitutionality or otherwise of holding a company vicariously and legally liable for the actions of its employees.
I see.
So they wanted to test this.
Yeah, they were looking to get right up to the Supreme Court and make their name. Yeah.
And I said, you're going to pick another company to polish your own marble. Yeah. I'm going to do the right thing. And the right thing is to do what's right for the pensioners who were compromised by this action, and to plead guilty.
I'm taking it the Zuma regime was the state capture that you wanted to avoid, and you got out and got away from. Once that regime ended, you've been able now to bring this package of teaching, ethics, and leadership to South African customs.
Yeah, I mean, I have no delusions of grandeur. I'm a servant. My entire leadership philosophy is stewardship. And stewardship is about understanding that you hold in trust what belongs to another. It's not yours. You're a shepherd, right? You're not the owner of the sheep. The sheep belongs to the farmer. But you put your life at risk, you know, in the interest of the sheep. Mm. And so that's who I am. I'm a shepherd. And for me, it's the 62 million people in South Africa whose lives, whose well-being I hold in trust through the work that I do. And secondly, you know, stewards serve the common interests, not their narrow self-interest. Doesn't mean they suspend their self-interest, because none of us can, but it means that you subjugate or you subject your personal interest to serve the common good. Mm. And then thirdly, stewards have this incessant yearning to bequeath something that is greater than they inherited.
Legacy. What are your biggest challenges that you face in being a good steward and in making sure that the tax revenues, which sounds like a real focus for you, are conserved and properly collected?
I think the first is and I always say this, in any organization, the soft stuff, they are the hard issues, right? The soft stuff is the hard stuff. And so it's easy to fix a technology platform. It's easy to manipulate data and to write algorithms, produce, you know, artificial intelligent products and artifacts. What's hard is building an organization where the DNA has integrity, where you have a culture where the entire organization, through evangelization, buys into the higher purpose that you stand for. And you cannot do that by legislating it. You can only do that by being it. If essentially, you put your life on the line. You are the script, if you want to lead like that. And people, don't put yourself out to be perfect, but be authentic. And be believable. And people inherently, my experience, want to be some part of something bigger than themselves, part of a worthy cause. And if they believe in the cause, there's no amount of sacrifice that they won't commit to. And so for me, the first order of business for a leader is to create an inspirational vision around a purpose that is noble and worthy, and to also not pretend to be a know-it-all, a savior or messiah. I'll send you a copy of the letter that I wrote on the first day. I started on the 1st of May 2019, and by 10 o'clock that morning, over a few days of knowing I'm coming, I had composed a letter to the staff. I'll come to the letter in a moment. But the first day was a public holiday, but I asked a few of the office staff in my office to come to work. And I said to them, I want this letter to go out, but I want you to mail merge it so that when Tom gets his letter, it'll say, Dear Tom. And not dear employees or dear colleagues. And when Edward gets his letter, it'll say, Dear Edward. And they said to me, that's going to be too difficult. They can't do it. I said to them, you know, this is my first assignment, and you're telling me we can't do it. We put men on the moon. We split the atom. You're telling me you cannot put a personalized letter out in the next 2 hours? Go back and come back when you have an answer. And that set the tone, right? And by midday that day, we started sending out personalized letters, and Tom would have got his letter that said, Dear Tom. And the letter made 4 points. The first point the letter makes is that I made it clear where I stood on the most important matter at the time of state capture. I said, I believe that state capture was real. It was motivated by a corrupt leadership intent, and that I am going to do what I can to reverse the damage caused by state capture. And those of you who are in denial about whether state capture took place, you are either complicit or you are indifferent. And to be either indifferent or complicit is dangerous. Wow. Let's talk about that. So that was the first message. After I said to them, I consider it to be an inordinate privilege to come back and lead. The second message was, I made a list of things. I said, this is what you can expect of me and hold me accountable for. And I set out what that is. And then my third message was, and this is what I expect of you and will hold you accountable for. And then my fourth message was to say, and if we can honor this, I have the confidence that together we can achieve the following things. And I listed what the things were. And of course, that was how I reintroduced myself to the organization. And it's been the pattern that we honored. And you know what's really wonderful? Is how those promises are being fulfilled through our collective efforts. You know, One of the things, for example, is revenue. And our revenue recovery in an economy that has been really pedestrian, has been growing at a compound annual growth rate of 7%, in an economy that's been fairly pedestrian.
Wow.
But within that, we have a very focused revenue recovery plan, which is revenue that is derived from specific compliance activities, like following up outstanding debt, raising additional assessment, preventing an impermissible or fraudulent refund. That in the last 4 years have grown on a compound average, compound annual growth rate of 22%.
Wow. Incredible.
22%. At the same time, we independently surveyed public trust. And 2018-2019, in an independent survey, we scored 48%. When we measured it at the first quarter of this year, public trust had gone from 48% to 66%.
Wow. In the revenue service.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
An attitude towards compliance went from 66% to 76.5%.
Among the general public, we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you
So let me give you one more data point and then I'll sum it up into a storyline. We then also do employee engagement surveys, right? When we set the baseline in 2020, we scored 61%, which is already a good score, right? It was 18 months into just over 15 months into my being there. We did the first survey. We then did the second survey at the beginning of this year. And let me just give you globally, from COVID to post-COVID, employee engagement went from 66% to 65%. Mm-hmm. In Africa, it went from 65% to 61%. Mm. In South Africa, it went from 66% to 62%. Mm. So globally, employee engagement had declined. In SARS, we went from 61.7% to 69.8%.
Wow.
Almost 70%.
Huh.
And our participation level was almost 70%, which in itself, you know, a good survey response is about 30%.
Right.
We had 7 out of every 10 people took part. So let me wrap that all up in a story. We are collecting taxes more efficiently, which means we're taking more money out of your pocket. But you trust us more. Your attitude towards paying taxes have improved. And our employees are working harder, but they're more fulfilled. I mean, that's the storyline. So it's been a phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's been a phenomenal journey. Look, we are far from finished. We certainly don't declare victory. But all of that is really encouraging and heartening and fulfills the purpose, the reason why I decided to go back.
This concludes the first half of my conversation with Edward Kieswetter, Commissioner of the South African Revenue Service and recently elected Chairperson of the World Customs Organization. Tune in next week for the second half of our talk. Thank you.